This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. If you don't have the time to luxuriate on the sofa with a French cookbook every afternoon to figure out what you're going to eat for dinner, try HelloFresh. You can get 50% off your first box by going to hellofresh.ca/theimposter, promo code imposter. This episode is also sponsored by Endy, the online mattress company that makes their mattresses in Canada, which means that they can avoid duties, currency exchange, and international shipping charges. And that means that you get a cheaper mattress. If you want to try an Endy mattress, you have 100 days to try it out and return it. You can get $50 off any mattress by going to endy.ca and entering the promo code IMPOSTER. Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aliyah Babani. On the last episode of my epic voyage through comedy, I took an 18-hour improv class at Second City so that I could learn to get out of my head a little bit and riff on stage. But I had some issues. One of them was pointed out to me by Misha Globerman, founder of the Misha Globerman School of Learning.
In terms of the skill that I think is the skill that's the really, really interesting skill about improv, which is like to be able to lose yourself in a collaboration with someone else, I don't think there is evidence that you're more advanced in that. And all the thinking about how good you are at the other stuff, like it actually makes you like worse at the part that I think is what improv is supposed to teach. You're actually worse at collaborating than most people in the class.
Yeah.
So you're actually not an expert. You're actually like a remedial student.
As it turns out, shutting off my critical, judgmental side enough to be able to really open up to other people is not really my strongest suit. And that's not just a useful skill for improv. It's a useful skill for life. But then, something happened between some of my classmates after improv class, and it made me not want to turn off my critical side. I was with some women from my class, and one of them told us about how a bunch of them went out for drinks after class the night before. There was this one guy who was going around showing everyone these checks that he had and asking people to read the dollar amounts on them. He kept trying to buy everyone rounds of shots, even though people were trying to just have a quick beer and then get to wherever they were going. And then at one point, he says to the woman who's telling us the story, and I feel weird going into the specifics, but he says something shitty about her body. She's shocked, and then he turns to another guy and he says, in front of her, she's hot, isn't she? And that made me wonder whether that quick sense of community that was created between strangers within the improv class somehow contributed to the violation that happened outside of it. Improv's about saying yes and to everything. It's about accepting what other people offer up and building on it so that you can create this limitless environment where funny things just seem to appear in a way that's confounding for the audience. And sometimes even for the performers. But that idea of improv imagines that it exists in a vacuum, apart from the power relations that have a huge impact on how we engage with each other in the real world. For yes and to be a mantra at a time when the culture is finally having to grapple with issues around consent feels complicated. I wanted to bring it up with some people who have been doing improv for years, even though I was a bit worried that they'd tell me that I was missing the point because, you know, that's happened once or twice when I've gone to people with comedy-related inquiries. But it turns out they had a lot to say about it.
I think that it's really interesting in improv because unlike stand-up, it's a collaborative thing. And it's important to be able to push. Mm-hmm. And we ask people to, at best, like look at their faults and present them on stage. So that the characters don't have to be perfect. They can be troubled characters. But if they have no sense of boundary or they just think they're being encouraged in life and not performance and they're not making the distinction, it can be extremely dangerous. We want consent and safety, but it also requires a collective danger to be good.
I think also one of the things that kind of separates, one of the things, it's the main thing that separates improv and stand-up is the fact that it is truly just the thing that you are thinking. Mm-hmm. And as an improviser, you really have to not be careful of what you say because ultimately good improv is honest improv. And at a certain level, like you can kind of be more dangerous with what you say. The beautiful thing about improv is that you can then actually explore why that's problematic within the scene and you address that as characters on the stage. But at the same time, like, it's very hard as an improviser right now, but I think that's a really good thing because I think it makes us all, when we get off stage, think about, hey, I now have to address what my personal sort of biases are and why I think or why I would say that or why that's in my head. And I think ultimately that's good as human beings that we can reflect on those sort of things. But the problem with improv is that it happens on stage in front of everyone. So you're like, well, I'm thinking about these things, but the audience can't really follow up with you. If you do happen to say something that is, if not offensive, then a bit controversial.
I asked whether any of them remembered saying something controversial on stage. Here's Becky Johnson.
I was on stage at Second City in the improv set with a performer who was black, and he was playing a character who was like not very smart, who was applying to get into university, and I was like the registrar, and at one point I was like, you know what, yeah, you can, like, we have quotas, and the audience went, oh, and what I was thinking in my mind was like, because we were having this game of him not being able to answer anything or whatever, and I was like, I was thinking intelligence level, and of course the audience all saw a white woman saying that to a black man. It was clear that that was not my intention to say that. Mm. But then we're sitting in there with the audience knowing it, like from the reaction, I imagine most of them knowing this wasn't what I intended. But then the scene could kind of be about that, and Al could, he was the one who had to deal with it a bit more than me, could like make it a bit, we could make a bit of a statement that I hadn't intended.
It's in those moments when you've got to just trust that your scene partner will give you the benefit of the doubt and that they'll step in and save you. But what about when you're that person and you're not about to save anybody? Kayla Lorette.
You get into shows all the time where there are people that are just, even when they're good improvisers, are being nastier. I don't want them to win on stage. Someone showboating, someone putting your character into a place of weakness or stupidity, over-sexualizing your character.
Or actual physical silence, being like, I'm your doctor and I just removed your, like, vocal cords. Like, that's a scene that could happen.
Yeah. Finding a way to, like, completely take away your power and agency on stage. When I see that behavior, there is, like, a deep, old pain in me that just wants to crush them with jokes and smother them until they're done.
Because the audience can see that. The audience can see when a person is being railroaded in a scene. And they are like, ugh, why is that happening? And then, you know, once you get to a level, you can demolish them.
If they are a bit crap to you, the way that you receive it is the way that the joke lands. Mm-hmm. I make your joke happen or not happen. You say something nasty to me, the entire audience turns all their heads and looks at me. And if I start crying, do you have a joke for that?
I asked if there was something particular about this form and the community that it creates that makes it difficult to identify these kinds of transgressions and then to do something about them. Here's Kayla again.
I would never want the community to lose the energy and the openness and the love that it does have. It makes the improv community wonderful, especially like across our country, the festivals you go to, it feels like a family, and when it's at its best, that is, I've seen more compassion and love and support in that community than any other comedy community, really. It's incredible. With that comes certain people, because of its openness, that will struggle with boundaries sometimes, mm-hmm. and the community has to deal with that as a community. With kindness or clarity and boundary, and that does get tricky because it is, the social stuff bleeds into the class, bleeds into the shows, and we're learning that those boundaries need to be there, we need to figure it out, but I don't want us to lose that sense of family and compassion. It's tough.
tension between maintaining the openness of the community and insulating it from abuse isn't anything new. And it's not unique to improv. Improv sits at the intersection of theater and comedy. And that means that it's informed by some of the best parts of both of those worlds. But it also carries their baggage. After the break, you'll hear from someone who's helping actors create intimate onstage moments while making sure that it doesn't spill into their offstage lives. This episode of The Impostor is brought to you by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. So, like a lot of you, probably, I grew up watching Oprah after school, but the Oprah that I grew up on was the boring era of Oprah. It was after the era where she was making that kind of trashy daytime talk show, like cheating husband type stuff, but before she started giving away cars. And there were a lot of episodes where she talked about her personal chef, this guy, Art Smith. So the major takeaway for me was that when I grow up, even if I don't own a house or have a car, I have to have a personal chef. Fast forward to today. I'm 32 years old, and I don't have a personal chef. But this is the future, and you can at least get yourself a percentage of a personal chef. HelloFresh works with chefs to come up with new healthy recipes every week with step-by-step instructions and the exact portions of produce and sauces and spices that you need to make them. And I know this isn't necessarily how you imagine the experience of a personal chef, but look, these meals take less than 30 minutes to make. It's not really cooking as much as it is assembling a meal. This time of the year is the worst time to have to drag yourself out to the grocery store. And if you want to try out HelloFresh instead, you can get 50% off your first week, which can work out to as little as $6 a meal. For 50% off your first box, go to HelloFresh.ca/TheImpostor and enter The Impostor at checkout. That's HelloFresh.ca/TheImpostor. This episode is also sponsored by Endy, the Canadian-made online mattress company that makes their own memory foam. It's comfortable and supportive, but it's also good for temperature control and something called motion transfer resistance, which is a schmancy way of saying that if you're sleeping on it with someone else, you won't feel it if they roll around. Since they sponsor the show, I went to Endy's website a couple of times, and then I started seeing all these Endy endorsement videos that featured Toronto Raptors power forward Serge Ibaka. And honestly, I find them extremely endearing. There is this one where Serge gives you sleep tips.
I play when I need to play. I sleep when I need to sleep.
That video ends with him lying down in bed and petting this white fuzzy thing that he calls Mafuzi. Okay, so Serge Ibaka's sleep tips are really poetic, but I wanted to get some sleep tips that were a little more concrete. So I asked my friend Gina, who is kind of a sleep guru.
And then for about an hour before you actually, like, turn out the light, to have a bit of a routine that's, like, geared toward relaxing. I like to avoid looking at screens.
What about podcasts?
Podcasts are a great thing to do. Yeah.
Do you have any recommendations for, like, podcasts that you would suggest?
Yeah.
Gina, I gotta let you go.
You gotta run?
Yeah, I really have to call. If you want to try out an Endy mattress, go to endy.ca, that's ENDY.ca, and you can get $50 off their already lower than market mattresses if you enter the promo code IMPOSTER at checkout. Like in a lot of spaces, theater's had a bit of a shakeup. Men in positions of power, veteran directors, producers, and performers have been outed for abuses going back decades. And while that's resulted in some very necessary measures like cleansing the ranks of known abusers, drafting better policies, and strengthening the ones that already exist, these changes don't often address the dynamics between actors who still have to go into work and interact with each other on stage in these intimate and physical and often unpredictable ways. There's a team of choreographers who are trying to take the guesswork out of onstage sex scenes. And I spoke to one of them about it.
Hi, I'm Siobhan Richardson. I'm an intimacy director as well as an actor.
So, Siobhan, you work with a company called Intimacy Directors International.
Mm-hmm.
I love the name. It kind of sounds like a feminist spy collective.
Fine.
I just wanted to know how you got into that kind of work.
As an intimacy director?
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a show and I needed to kiss somebody on stage. And it was a perfectly safe space, but I kind of froze. I was like, oh my goodness, I don't know what to do in this moment. And I don't have a process for this. How am I over 30 and I don't have a process for this? So around that time, Tonya Sina had written an article for Fightmaster magazine, which is the Society of American Fight Directors trade magazine. So in there, she had written an article called Safe Sex, which was about the choreographing of scenes of intimacy for the stage. And in there had her kissing protocol. So when I read that, I went, oh, okay, this is what I need. So it took a bit of time, but I got her up here in order to do some workshops. And I became really interested in the work, not only as like, here's a process for approaching the choreography, but I found that her acting exercises and that approach to it just like instantly made me a better actor. Because it was about accessing vulnerability in a way that was simple and clear, as opposed to you have all these words to say and this imaginary context to uphold and now be vulnerable with the person in front of you as well. Mm. So that's, yeah.
What are the overlaps between fight and intimacy direction?
It's just movement. It's really just movement with acting principles in there. So it is about, I am present with my partner, I'm reacting with my partner. But as far as storytelling and showing the audience something really specific, it comes down to specific physical actions. It comes down to communicating with your scene partner. It also comes down to how do you use your breath? How do you use the language of touch? What kind of touch am I using? Is it a soft touch? Is it a firm touch? Am I using one finger? Am I using my whole palm? Am I pressing my whole body against you? We're also looking at principles of rhythm, principles of how do we use the space that we're in? So what's that image for the audience?
Mm.
Now, sex and violence, so intimacy and fight direction, they're both really lizard brain kind of things. So those are like deep down instinctive things. And we as humans in this society don't necessarily have contact with our cognitive relationship to those deep instinctive places. And the people who are directing those scenes tend to also need a little bit more awareness of this is how it affects you as a human being. Mm-hmm. So that I can, as a director, coach my actors through. So it's going to feel like this and your body's going to do things. You might feel this way, but it's an imaginary context. So let's give you practices and rituals as you might have in order to separate your experience of the imaginary context from your experience of your real life context.
Mm.
If it's a scene of intimacy, we can take away a showmance. We can take away that sense of like, oh, I love you. I really do. Actually, your character loves that character, which is sort of embodied by that person's face, by that actor's face. But you and that actor aren't necessarily in love. Not that you can't find love at work. You can. But I offer that if you are serially finding love at work in your romantic scene partner, that perhaps your containing of that context might benefit from some examination.
That is a wonderfully convoluted way of being supportive and getting the sense of how good you must be at communicating around these things.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And like it's open, but also let's figure out where the space between people's boundaries is.
Exactly. And that's part of this whole revolution that's going on right now is some people are triggered by this, some people are not. And that's part of navigating your own instrument, both physical and psychological as an artist is I can recognize that that story needs to be told, but I don't necessarily need to be the one to tell it.
Mm.
So if there is material that I go, oh, that's a really important story, but the way it's told is triggering for me, that's not healthy for me to do that job unless I have amazing emotional fitness going into it and I can work on that. I can find my strategies for that. I have amazing self-care during the work. I'm going to work on that before I get into the show so that I don't accidentally use the show as therapy. When it comes to this kind of work, part of the process that I learned from Tonya is this idea of containers. So that we're taking a look at one aspect of the work we wish to explore And then we do a simple version of that so that there's very few expectations, but we can really engage in that one direction.
What's an example of what that looks like?
So one of the first exercises that we do, creating a connection between you and your scene partner and being able to trust them, is simply making eye contact. So we spend some time just making eye contact. There is no other expectation, and just spend some time with them. And so you can trust that that person is going to look you in the eye, and they're going to sense when your mood changes because they're with you in that moment. So we're not expecting people to go and now make a beautiful love scene and be connected. We're just going right to be connected. We're just going to do that first with nothing else involved. That's also part of creating trust, and being in a space of trust is being able to say, ooh, that was, I feel more vulnerable because that hurt me. And in a great space, you know that someone else is going to say, I'm sorry, that wasn't my intent. I didn't mean to hurt you. Let's speak about what specifically is that problem and how do we resolve it, or how do we avoid it in future?
Did starting to do this work help you understand what happened to you in that initial moment where you froze up on stage?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like in rehearsal. Yeah. It was totally just me not having a sense of where is the story going and so what's expected of me. So because they kiss, as an example, is really shorthand for a whole bunch of story. Just like they fight is shorthand for a whole bunch of story. They fight might be punch, punch, slap, which would be actually kind of funny.
not the best choreography.
Not the best choreography, but or it could be brilliant choreography, because if it's meant to be funny, punch, punch, slap is a good one.
Why would you choose a slap third?
Everybody write that down. So similarly, what I think happened to me in that rehearsal was I was like, okay, now I'm supposed to press my lips to your lips, but why? And how long? And what does it mean for these characters? And do I open my mouth? Do I close my mouth? Do I put my arms around you? Do I not put my arms around you? Do I touch you at all except for my lips? Do I? So I think that's what was happening, is that inner monologue, because as humans, we interact through the world through story. So in that moment where I had no story, I had no awareness of story, my brain started going off and like, hey, what story can I make out of this moment? Oh, I'm feeling awkward. So that's what's happening. I'm, for people who can't see me, I'm making, I have a little puppet mouth that is enacting my brain.
Which is really
at the moment.
Integral to this, to this story.
Yeah. So I think that's what happened. And for whatever reason, it had just never occurred to me that's what's happening there.
Mm. You spoke about kind of how people take certain things for granted in fight choreography, and fight choreography has been a thing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about intimacy choreography? It's more of the moment. What happened, basically, that people realized that intimacy choreography was something that was necessary?
Many, many things. Lots of stuff in the news and a growing awareness. So the unions, for instance, had put out a survey with regards to harassment in the workplace. So that was coming out. That information was coming back. Canadian Actors Equity Association has developed the Not an Hour Space campaign, which is essentially a clarification and publicization of what is harassment, what is bullying, what's a toxic work environment. And it's still very new. So like any new project, there's still some wrinkles being ironed out, and there's lots of people working on that.
What were the revelations of that survey?
There's a lot more harassment happening in rehearsal spaces and in theater workspaces. We have a record now of people who have reported, which is, of course, different than when it's actually happening, but to have concrete numbers for that. So, and I think the results are online. So for clarity and specificity, because I don't have those. Mm-hmm. So other things that happened were the Profiles Theater situation in Chicago. The artistic director had been essentially abusing his employees by doing fight and intimacy choreography that was not planned. For example, somebody was like actually knocked out on stage. So you just go, well, that's not a sustainable show. Audience one is not getting the same show as audience 100. And yes, there's absolutely space for shows that use more of an improvisational aspect. But when it comes to someone sustaining brain injury, it's not sustainable. And humans are not resources to be used up.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, the audience feels something, but the audience can tell when the actor is involved or when the character is involved. We want them engaged in the character's conflicts, in their resolutions. We're not interested actually in watching an actor and wondering if the actor is okay. That's a different kind of entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As all of these things were happening, then it was like, oh, hang on, here's part of the solution that we're missing. There's a lot of focus on safe workspaces, and then this jigsaw puzzle piece of, but then how do we approach these moments? And it's choreography. We communicate about it. We discuss what the story is. We create choreography that tells that story. And then we repeat that choreography so that we're not relying on how much do the actors like each other today. We're not accidentally or intentionally, as sometimes the case has been, crossing over other people's boundaries in order to do the work. And it all comes down to let's serve the work as well as we can while, and this is a big important part of it, while respecting our people.
I'm wondering if you can just kind of walk me through like a quick list of things that you're trying to avoid in this. So like, I don't know, if I were to think of like fight choreography, what are the things you are trying to avoid on stage with fight choreography in the same way? What are the kind of things that you're trying to steer clear of in intimacy choreography that are, you know, potential trappings of that kind of work on stage?
Sure. What we're looking to do is to avoid any situation where there's accidental grabs or intentional. But there's so many people out there who have been in scenes where their scene partner violates their personal safety by grabbing them, by putting their tongue in their mouth when it wasn't agreed upon, or, hey, it's the last night of the show, let's like really make out this time. A, that's not acting. That's you making out in front of an audience. And if it's one person doing it and the other person not consenting, well, that's assault. That's assault in front of an audience. Is that actually what you mean to do? Or do you mean to be an actor and tell a story? And that idea hasn't necessarily been clear until very recently. If you want your scene partner on a personal level, then approach them and ask them in a way that's what we do in this society, whether you find them on Tinder or whether you ask them, hey, I find you really interesting. Do you want to go for a drink sometime? I would also say like maybe wait until like a month after the show closes just to make sure that you, the person, want them, the person. So that's also part of like the psychological safety and the clarity of that. And that is one of the other things we're looking to help people avoid is accidental emotional bleed off. There is a study done where actors delivered text as characters and just spoke as themselves. And it comes from the same place in the brain. Your system does not understand that that is not a real experience until you consciously make efforts to say, this is my workspace, this is my real life. So one of the reasons for choreographing intimacy is to help us with that.
What do you do with improv? Like, what do you do with a theater scenario, or have you ever encountered a theater scenario where nothing is scripted, and how do you build that kind of same scenario in that context?
Great question. So one of the things that you can do is just like you might do a pact ahead of the scene for like, I don't know, my shoulder is sprained, so don't touch my shoulder. Likewise, you might say my physical boundaries are no breasts, no genitals. So if there's a sensor bar there, don't touch it. Don't shove me. Don't put your hands on my neck. Whatever those boundaries are, you just declare that ahead of time. We tend to think of boundaries as all the no that we have. But remember that these walls are a boundary to this room, but that doesn't mean we don't have space in this room. We have a lot of stuff to play with in this room. So it's essentially introducing people to your room and saying, here's let's go to my basement, to the rec room, and here are all my toys. Like, it's kind of like that. It can, the idea of boundaries should be the idea of joy, as opposed to thinking of it as a place of no. Our boundaries are simply saying, come to my rec room. We can't go upstairs. We're not allowed to go into the furnace room, but we can play in here. I have a Wii. And we also have to remember that we have yes and. We also have no however. Even if the scene has sort of led up to this idea of we're going to make out as soon as that other character leaves, then you just come up with a no however once you're faced with that moment. So that you also don't need to feel like you're letting down your scene partner somehow when they offer a thing and then you say no however. You're respecting your boundary. They're pushing yours. And that might be something where you say to somebody, this is a harder boundary than the other ones. And I really need you to not reach for my ears because maybe I've said, don't touch my ears. I've got to think about my ears. This one, like, I don't want to kiss you in front of like 300 people. But if you go towards it, I'll come up with something funny to do instead.
That was Siobhan Richardson, whose furnace room is off limits. You also heard from Alia Rasool, Anne Cornell, Becky Johnson, and Kayla Lorette, who will smother you with jokes until you're done. Find out where they're performing next in the show notes. I produced this episode of The Imposter with Ali Graham, with assistance from Angela Shackle. Our theme music is by Nate Burley. You can follow us on Twitter at Imster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can follow me at Aliyah Pabani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, and it's the golden age of podcasting, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.